Has this ever happened to you? You wake up, look at your phone, scroll through the news for a minute or two, and then think, wow, how did we get here? Well, that's the question we tackle every week on NPR's Throughline podcast. We tell you the surprising stories of the people who made our history.
Carl Sagan was in people's living rooms talking about the wonders of the universe, making science feel personal and important to an everyday person.
Listen to Throughline from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
Two Chinese prisoners of war were captured in Ukraine. Today, they appeared at a press conference.
There were two men in the military uniform, and they were flanked by heavily armed guards of Ukrainian security service.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. We take you to that scene in Kyiv. Also, a visit to the U.S.-Mexico border, where the communities most affected by water pollution. Are taking matters into their own hands.
For Hungary's LGBTQ community, a ban on the Pride Parade is being seen as a wake-up call.
When you live in Hungary, you're kind of used to your rights stripped away, but this was just like a next step.
Plus, a new threat to French cheese.
That's all ahead today on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman, coming to you from San Diego.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler, also coming to you from San Diego this week. We are happy to be broadcasting from the studios at KPBS.
This region is famous for waves breaking on sandy beaches.
Quite a mix of swell energy on the buoys. That's providing all regions in the county with surfing opportunities.
Mild weather, relaxed vibes.
But there is a lot more to the cross-border region that spans San Diego and Tijuana.
San Diego doesn't always get seen as this cultural city.
An engaging community, diverse.
Tijuana's got an experimental DNA in it.
It includes bilingual communities.
Pero todos los rectángulos son cuadrados.
And we don't just share culture. For folks making use of one of the busiest land border crossings on the planet, there's also the traffic.
Hour 40, the wait, San Ysidro, hour 10, Otay Mesa.
Over the coming week, we're going to look at some of the big issues that unite and divide people on both sides of this international border. We start today with something that locals pay close attention to, water pollution.
As the San Diego-Tijuana region continues to grow, so does a decades-old sewage problem. Industry has long outpaced the wastewater infrastructure in Tijuana. Now residents of one East Tijuana neighborhood tucked between multinational factories are saying they think it's more than sewage and rain that's running down their streets and into the river. Investigative reporter Philip Salata has more.
The canyons of Ejido Chilpancingo, a neighborhood just a couple kilometers south of the border, used to be lined with freshwater creeks. Now it's a dense neighborhood nestled below a hilltop lined by factories producing electronics and car parts, among other things. And that trickle you hear? It's wastewater tumbling down the hillside and across a pedestrian path a family just descended. And residents say they've seen it flow in all sorts of colors.
Colores verdes, anaranjados, rojos, azules.
Green, orange, red, blue, and foamy, says Alejandra Nieto, who lives in the area. Nieto is a part of the Colectivo Salud y Justicia Ambiental, an environmental justice group in Tijuana that has been fighting for public health causes linked with the maquiladora industry for decades. While their kids and grandkids are at school, they gather to hold local officials accountable for the impacts of industry on their neighborhood.
Mi nombre es Ale Nieto, tengo ya 5 años en el colectivo.
Le digo, bienvenido, mi nombre es Ana Langarica y soy miembro aquí del colectivo ya por 20 años.
Bienvenido, mi nombre es Yesenia Palomares y tengo 25 años aquí en el colectivo.
The Colectivo just published a unique study along with U.S.-based researchers Carolina Prado and Guillermo Douglas Jaimes. Over 4 months, the team engaged community members in several East Tijuana neighborhoods to survey the urban runoff flowing down their streets and to document how it's impacting lives and livelihoods. Prado, a professor of environmental justice at San Francisco State University, says that public officials have told the community that rain and lack of adequate stormwater infrastructure are the problem. But she says people in the community suspect it's coming from the factories.
So there's a lot of perspectives that the sources of the water are not rain. It's not pluvial flooding. And so the project is the monitoring. And that was to look at, yeah, like the temporal patterns, the relationship between when there was water present and when it rained.
The study compiled community source data that tracked runoff flowing through the streets during dry weather. The team says the next step is to test the water for contaminants and identify the runoff's sources. They say not only does the runoff smell of raw sewage, but it often gives off the stench of chemicals, and it's making them sick.
Headaches, gastrointestinal issues, nausea, or some of the other ones were skin issues. Like I would get like, you know, my skin breaks out or I get a rash.
A spokesperson from the State Commission of Public Services in Tijuana says they plan to start fixing the sanitation systems in the area by next year. Much of what doesn't remain in the neighborhood ends up in the channelized Alamar River that feeds into the Tijuana River, which crosses back to the U.S. where it flows into waterways in South San Diego communities. South Bay residents have been complaining about the same health problems. Imperial Beach Mayor Paloma Aguirre talked about it recently at a press conference in the Tijuana River estuary.
I'm the one that gets the calls from South San Diego residents who can't breathe, who have COPD, who have sinusitis and migraines and headaches.
Since 2018, over 100 billion gallons of wastewater have flowed down the Tijuana River, plaguing communities along the way on both sides of the border.
We've had over 1,200 consecutive days of beach closures, devastating our local economy.
Kevin Malone, a historian at Texas Tech University, says the cross-border sewage crisis is largely the result of economic policies that have fueled industrial expansion in the border region. He says the pollution is
one unintended consequence of the rapid growth that has benefited American companies. And I would argue more broadly, the American economy at the expense of people who live in the border region.
Residents of East Tijuana are on the front lines of those consequences. That's one reason the colectivo and the researchers have set their sights on learning the sources of the pollution. They say officials don't take them for their word. You're not going to come and tell me what I see, smell, and feel. Alejandra Nieto says if they have to test the water themselves to convince officials of the problem, they will. For The World, I'm Philip Salata, Tijuana, Mexico.
Philip Salata covers the environment and energy for the San Diego investigative news outlet iNewsSource. He stopped by the studio here at KPBS to talk about the bigger issues at play. Hey, Philip, thanks for joining us.
A pleasure to be here.
So just to orient us, can you describe the area at the border where the Tijuana River meets the ocean?
Certainly. So the Tijuana River watershed spans both sides of the border, and you have influxes of water coming down canyons and into the river that kind of snakes through Tijuana and ends up crossing the border and opens up into a big estuary and into the Pacific Ocean. And that's kind of abutting communities in the South Bay of San Diego.
And there are concerns about pollution there, clearly. Is there a smell that you can describe to us to take us there?
Absolutely. There is a smell that has gotten noxious enough to have residents in the area saying that it's making them nauseous. I mean, it's a funky kind of egg-like smell.
Sulfury.
And it is sulfur, yeah, indeed, yes.
So you mentioned in the story we just heard that residents in Tijuana are concerned about factory waste. What other sources of pollution are impacting this watershed and do people talk about a lot when we talk about pollution in this area?
The sewage crisis really goes back several decades. I mean, it dates back as far as the Prohibition era, where U.S. entrepreneurs kind of opened up all of these businesses and had a huge influx of workers from all across Mexico coming in and kind of growing out the city and outpacing how fast the infrastructure can be built. So a lot of the sewage is wastewater that's not properly channelized, right?
So wastewater infrastructure has not been able to keep up with rapid development.
Correct.
Your story makes clear that water pollution does not stop at national borders, obviously. How does that complicate efforts to clean it up?
This is truly a binational problem.
Yeah.
The U.S. has a federally run wastewater treatment plant at the border. That plant has been working since the 90s, but it's been severely underfunded. So that has made all those repairs that need to be made have caused all sorts of sewage leaks. Hundreds of billions of gallons are flowing into the Pacific Ocean of untreated wastewater. every couple of weeks we hear of new flows into the river. And in terms of Tijuana, there's a plant that is supposed to be going online now in the next couple of months. But that process has been very slow and also an underfunded process.
It sounds to me like the progress you're talking about is happening sort of either on the U.S. side or the Mexico side of the border. Is there any increasing collaboration here to tackle this issue that is a cross-border issue?
Yes, indeed. I mean, the federal government now under the IBWC, it's the federal entity that governs the water issue along the border. That entity has now spent a huge amount of energy to come to agreements with Mexico and make sure that the timeline to fix all this infrastructure is amped up. The rhetoric has really changed in these last couple of years.
So it sounds like there's been some progress.
There is progress, but as fast as that progress goes, the problem is worsening, right? So over these last 5 years, we've seen a huge influx of untreated wastewater flows into the river. And the region is expanding faster than the problem is being resolved. So even when these two plants are up and running in the next couple of years, we still will not have solved the overall issue, right? The issue is outpacing the answers.
And that is largely because growth, both residential and commercial, industrial, is outpacing the wastewater infrastructure still.
Indeed.
So we've been talking here a lot about water quality and how it impacts local communities, how it impacts beaches when they're shut down. Are there additional environmental concerns from all of this?
Absolutely. So California has lost about 90% of its estuaries.
Wow.
And the Tijuana River estuary is one of the critical ecosystems in the area. It's a stopping point on the Pacific Flyway, which is, you know, billions of birds that go north and south stop there at the estuary. There are endangered species there as well. And I think there's another issue is with all of that pollution that's pouring into the river and the sediment that is lodging itself into the estuary, it stops that kind of natural flow of and flushing that happens in that ecosystem. And so you get pollutants stuck in there, and eventually that leads to fish die-offs. I think it's important to mention that the beaches along that area have been closed now for 3 years. And the pollution has moved as far north as Coronado, which is a couple of miles north of the border. So, I mean, it is an environmental and public health disaster.
Philip, you know this issue well. I'm wondering if you can imagine what this watershed could look like if it were restored again and healthy.
You know, I took a boat ride with one of the Coastal Conservancy groups the other day, and I've seen some of their projects of restoring the area and making sure that the fish populations are able to thrive. We live in an incredibly rich and diverse ecosystem here with so much migration, so much life and movement. It's a beautiful coastal region that, you know, gets articulated and shaped differently on both sides of the border. And I'm thinking a lot about the richness of this environment and hoping that it can resurge. And I do see that it can resurge quite quickly with the right conditions. So that's what I'm hopeful for.
Philip Salata is the environment and energy reporter for the San Diego investigative news outlet iNewsSource. Thank you so much for joining us, Philip.
Thank you very much.
The president of El Salvador, Nayib Bukele, met today with President Trump at the White House to discuss the fate of migrants being deported to El Salvador. One case that has drawn a lot of attention, Kilmar Abrego Garcia, a Maryland father who was mistakenly deported last month.
Justice Department officials have acknowledged that Garcia should not have been sent to El Salvador, and the Supreme Court has ruled that he should be returned to the United States. When asked whether he would send Garcia back, though, here is what Bukele said.
The question is preposterous. How can I smuggle a terrorist into the United States? I don't have the power to return him to the United States.
So far, there is no evidence of Garcia committing any crime.
Since March, El Salvador has taken in more than 200 Venezuelan immigrants from the U.S. They are being held inside the country's notorious maximum security prison just outside the capital, San Salvador. President Trump says he wants more of these prisons built.
As many as possible.
The U.S. has agreed to pay about $6 million for El Salvador to hold the deportees for a year. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Officials from Iran and the U.S. met in the Gulf nation of Oman over the weekend to talk about Iran's nuclear program. That program's been an ongoing source of tension for the U.S. and Israel, though Iran has long insisted that it's developing nuclear energy strictly for non-military purposes. The world's Shirin Jafari has been following the talks. First of all, Shirin, give us more details about the meeting over the weekend. This was hotly anticipated, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The U.S. had hoped to speak directly with Iranian officials, but Iran wasn't too keen on that. So that's why representatives from the country of Oman acted as intermediaries. They went back and forth between the two sides something like four times. And we don't have specific details about what they discussed, but what we know is that they agreed to meet again next weekend in Rome, Italy. Emma Ashford is with the Stimson Center, which is a think tank in Washington, D.C. She tells me that it seems like this meeting turned out to be a positive first step. She says that there were a lot of doubts going into it.
Whether the Trump administration would walk in with a demand that was essentially unmeetable for the Iranians, that they fully denuclearize, and that does not appear to have been the case. So this seems like a promising start.
So there was a lot of debate, Shirin, about whether this was going to be a direct meeting or an indirect one. I mean, it may be obvious, but what is the difference and why did it seem there were cross wires on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, the U.S. says that this is important because it wants to be talking directly to the Iranian decision makers. For Iran, this is important because speaking with American officials is taboo domestically, and the Iranian negotiators are careful about not giving the conservatives inside the country any excuse to derail these talks. So very sensitive moment, and optics are really important here, Marco, as much as the substance. Having said all that, it's been reported that the Iranian foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, did in fact meet face-to-face in Oman with President Trump's envoy, Steve Witkoff, and they spoke for about 45 minutes.
Wow, so it was direct in the end.
Direct and indirect. It depends on who you ask.
Right. So the U.S. did have a nuclear deal with Iran, the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, which Trump pulled out of in his first term. Remind us what happened there.
The Obama administration negotiated a deal with Iran in 2015, and after about 2 years of back and forth, Iran did agree to downsize its nuclear program. But in 2018, President Trump walked away from that deal, saying that it wasn't strong enough and that the U.S. had given away too many concessions.
Yeah, so is quitting the JCPOA a few years ago now casting a shadow as the U.S. and Iran try to inch their way back to the negotiating table?
Iranian officials have repeatedly mentioned this issue as the reason why they're skeptical of any future deals with the U.S. because they say, look, we don't have any guarantees that President Trump won't walk away again from another deal. But Emma Ashford says that this previous deal, which was negotiated in 2015, actually helps with these current negotiations.
There will certainly need to be a process with experts involved figuring out things like, you know, how to dilute Iranian high enriched uranium or what sanctions relief might look like today. But a lot of this has already been worked out in the past by experts. So I would think that the Iran talks are likely to move a lot faster than, say, the Ukraine talks.
And then the big question, Shirin, why does the U.S. want to deal with Iran now?
Well, Trump has promised not to let Iran develop nuclear weapons. But since 2018, Iran's nuclear program has advanced. The U.S. also sees Iran in a weak position at this moment, and it believes that it is a good time to squeeze out concessions. Iran's allies in the region, like Hezbollah, have been severely weakened by Israel. Another one of its allies, Syria's President Bashar al-Assad, is no longer in power. So Iran doesn't have the same regional standing that it did back in 2018. Another important factor is that Iran's economy hasn't been doing great, and this is a time when Iran needs to get sanctions relief to survive.
That's the world's Shirin Jafari.
Some distressing news now about cheese. Two beloved French cheese varieties are at risk of disappearing. Brie and Camembert are produced all around the world, but there's still basically one fungus strain used to ripen all of it. So any threats to that fungus could spell culinary disaster. The world's Jerry Hatton brings us this cheese dispatch from Paris.
The science is in, and with it a warning. We've been coddling the Camembert and Brie for too long, causing the fungus that gives them their flavor to grow weak and unprotected.
So what are we looking at here? Which one is the Camembert fungus?
So that would be the like the Penicillium camemberti. So we can see petri dish with sugar and everything needed for the fungi to grow.
They look like little cotton balls.
I'm in a lab at the University of Paris-Saclay staring at cultures with cheese fungus investigator Tatiana Giroux because, yeah, in France, cheese gets its own lab.
So we compare the fungi that we use to make the cheeses to their close relatives, plant pathogens, just eating plants.
Okay, and their close relatives are in nature, naturally.
Yeah, exactly. The wild and the domesticated population, just as we can compare dogs and wolves.
Jules is worried because what's wild, like a wolf, is inherently stronger than something domesticated, like, say, a sweater-wearing chihuahua. In the world of fungus, wild predators, such as bacteria and amoebas, now threaten the all-important Penicillium camemberti. And that could affect cheese production wherever the same strain is used. The problem began back in 1898, when French farmers managed to produce the pleasing and profitable Brie and Camembert we know today, light and creamy, with a uniform color.
The fact that the Camembert and Brie are white now is due to the isolation by a scientist of an albino strain, so a mutant who just lost his ability to make the pigment, the color. Before that, people used the more greenish fungi to make the Camembert and the Brie.
Cheesemakers isolated the albino fungus to keep it safe and intact. The problem is it hasn't mixed and mingled with other fungi, diversifying its genome.
So without diversity, you cannot adapt to new conditions.
And if they can't,
they are doomed, in the sense that mutations will accumulate and eventually could lead to the disappearance of the species as we know it now.
That's fellow fungus researcher Ricardo Rodriguez de la Vega. He says the Penicillium camemberti is not only vulnerable to disease, but it's also losing its ability to reproduce. On an impromptu randonnée around cheese shops in Paris, news of the endangered fungus doesn't go down well. Seller Peter Gérard says if you take the Brie and Camembert from his display, he'd lose half his sales.
Un grand classique du fromage français, c'est un très grand classique, le Brie et le Camembert.
Because they're great French classics, he says. I couldn't imagine a world without them.
C'est des fromages qui sont très connus en France et aussi à l'étranger, donc on a beaucoup de touristes.
In another cheese store, owner Elena Leblanc says Brie and Camembert aren't just French favorites. Tourists buy them up too. Leblanc says she hopes the same scientists warning about the cheese's demise can figure out a way to save them. And there is a way, by carefully crossing the fungus with other strains, building back up its genetic diversity, rewilding it, basically. The one downside, the classic creamy white aspect consumers expect, would likely get lost in the genetic shuffle, replaced by the Camembert and Brie of old, greenish with mottled, moldy crusts. Harder to market, maybe, but saved from oblivion. For The World, I'm Cherry Haddon, Paris.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Two prisoners of war sat on a press conference stage in Kyiv today, flanked by members of the Ukrainian security services. They told journalists that they are Chinese nationals, but they said they did not anticipate fighting in Ukraine. They believe they would be doing non-combat roles such as rehabilitation or construction work.
President Zelensky says more than 150 Chinese nationals are fighting with Russian troops. China, meanwhile, denies any involvement in Russia's war. Ukrainian journalist Volodymyr Soloviov was at today's press conference in Kyiv. He explained what we know so far about the two Chinese prisoners of war.
Today, the press conference, they were brought in person in front of the media by Ukraine's security service. Both men are in their early 20s. They say that they were out of the job. They were looking for ways to get some supplemental income. And that's when they came across these advertisements on social media that were portraying this opportunity to go to Russia and work for the army, but not fight, not participate in the combat activities. That was very attractive to them. They said that they did not want to be participating in the fighting. So they answered these ads. They came to Russia. And soon after, they obviously found themselves on the battlefield. They say that they were deceived by the Russian recruits and the Russian military, and they were sent on the battlefield, Carolyn.
So this is two Chinese POWs who were sitting for questions today. But what does President Zelensky say about the role that Chinese troops, more of them, are playing in this conflict?
There have been multiple reports of Russia trying to recruit all sorts of foreign nationals to their war against Ukraine. There's quite open participation by the North Korean troops in the thousands in the war against Ukraine, but those are confined to the territory of Russia. The difference with these two Chinese nationals was that, according to Ukrainian military, they were captured on the territory of Ukraine fighting for Russia.
Right. So as you've said, we've known that North Koreans have been fighting. There have also been reports of Nepali and Syrian fighters joining Russian forces as well. Is there anything else that is significant about Chinese nationals specifically being captured in this fight, aside from the fact that they were fighting within Ukrainian territory?
Well, yes, Carolyn. China has always, at least officially, maintained a distance from this war. They claim that they would like to see a peaceful resolution to this Russian-Ukrainian war. But at the same time, China is Russia's most important and most strategic ally. And obviously, a lot of Russia's trade and economy is tied to China.
And what is Beijing saying about these two Chinese nationals fighting for Russia, or Chinese nationals in general fighting for them?
Once President Zelensky made this information public that Ukrainian military has captured two Chinese POWs, Ukrainian Foreign Ministry reached out to their Chinese counterparts, and Chinese Foreign Ministry said that they are working together with Ukrainian authorities and looking into this matter.
But do they maintain that there are not Chinese nationals fighting with Russia?
According to Chinese Ministry of Foreign Affairs, they have not officially sanctioned the participation of these Chinese individuals in the war against Ukraine.
Vladimir, Article 13 of the Geneva Convention states that prisoners of war must be protected, particularly against acts of violence or intimidation, and also against insults and public curiosity. How does Ukraine justify bringing these POWs out in public in front of journalists, flanked by security services, and subject to questions from journalists?
Yes, Caroline, I think Ukraine was walking a very thin line between adhering to the provisions of the Geneva Convention and trying to show to the whole world, as President Zelensky said, that Russia is using all sorts of means, including these deceitful means of luring in foreign nationals by promising them high payments, a lot of money, to try and somehow either win or prolong this war against Ukraine.
So they're saying they need to prove something in particular by having these men subject to, you know, a press conference rather than providing their statement in some other way?
I think this was a way to showcase and allow journalists access to the soldiers. And I think it was a way of showing and proving to the world that these individuals were indeed the Chinese nationals, allow them to tell the story to the world media and explain how they ended up being in Ukrainian detention.
Vladimir, before this press conference today, a lot of attention was already focused on Ukraine because of an overnight bombing in Sumy, Ukraine. Can you tell me about that?
Yes, Caroline. That was another horrific attack by Russians on a major Ukrainian city. Moreover, it happened on a Palm Sunday, where a lot of people were either on their way to the church or already going back from the church. As of today, the total toll of this attack is around 34 people killed and over 100 people injured. Most of them are civilians. And again, it shows again and again that Russia is not willing to have any peace talks. Russia is not willing to end this war. They just need more time.
Ukrainian journalist Volodymyr Soloub talking with me from Kyiv.
A British lawmaker who flew to Hong Kong to meet her newborn grandson was refused entry. Vera Hobhouse is a member of the UK Parliament with the Liberal Democrat Party. She arrived at the Hong Kong airport on Thursday with her husband. He went through without a problem, but Hobhouse says she was detained, questioned, then told she would be sent back to the UK.
She said she was given no explanation for being refused entry to the Chinese territory. Speaking with the BBC earlier today, Hobhouse said she's never been particularly outspoken about human rights in China, but that she won't let this incident intimidate her.
That is the last thing that should happen, but that is, of course, probably the intention, to shut me up and to silence me.
British Foreign Secretary David Lammy said he will demand an explanation from Beijing, and that is, quote, unacceptable for an MP to be denied entry for simply expressing their views as a parliamentarian. When asked about this case, China's foreign ministry said it's up to the authorities in Hong Kong to handle affairs at the border.
A new law banning Hungary's Pride Parade goes into effect tomorrow. The government of Viktor Orban says the goal of the legislation is to protect children from being exposed to messages that conflict with, quote, traditional family values. In recent weeks, protests have broken out in the capital, Budapest, with Orban's critics saying the ban is about much more than just a parade. The World's Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports.
Writer Christian Martin knows all about Hungary's anti-LGBTQ laws. A little over a year ago, he wrote a novel about growing up gay and mixed race in Hungary.
It is pretty much a chronicle of my journey. You know, I was 5 years old when I first saw someone who looked like me. And that guy was Eddie Murphy in Coming to America in the movie theater. So for a brief moment, I thought that Eddie Murphy was my dad.
Martin's novel attracted a lot of attention in Hungary. It won a top prize at one of the country's prestigious book festivals. But the novel was taken off the shelves at the festival because of legislation outlawing what the government called the promotion of homosexuality anywhere that children might be present.
My book and many other books that even mention the LGBTQ community cannot be sold in any store that has a church or a school in its 200-meter radius.
Still, Martin says, banning Budapest Pride Parade is next level.
When you live in Hungary, you're kind of used to your rights stripped away, but this was just like a next step.
And it's been a wake-up call, he says, not just for the LGBTQ community. Every week since the ban was announced, protesters of all ages and genders have gathered in central Budapest. Many say they're there not just because of the ban on Pride. If we don't stand up for the rights of minorities and our own fundamental rights, protester Victoria Vaidu says, then who will when they come for us? Marta Pardavi, with the Hungarian Helsinki Committee, a human rights NGO, says the Hungarian government might say it's all about protecting children, but stirring up culture wars is an age-old trope of Orban's, she says, and one he usually throws out when he's in trouble.
We're a year away from the next general elections, and there is a political competitor to Mr. Orban's Fidesz party, who seems to be on the rise. Also, Hungary's economy, particularly its budget situation, is quite concerning.
The Hungarian economy has been stuck in a rut for several years. The threat of US tariffs aren't helping, and an opposition lawmaker is currently topping Orban in the polls. The new law is also stirring debate among lawmakers in Brussels.
Orban's further crackdown on society follows the next chapter of Putin's playbook.
A pride betiltása, mocskos homofóbia.
Viktor Orban friend.
The EU commissioner also condemned the move. But Tibor Dajufi, a social sciences professor at ELTE University in Budapest, says a statement from all EU leaders attacking Orban's new law could actually backfire.
That would help Orban in a way, because Orban is waging a symbolic war against Brussels, presenting Brussels as Moscow was in the 70s and the 80s, a kind of exploitative center. So it's a difficult question, what is the right policy to do?
One policy might be booting Hungary out of the bloc, but the EU doesn't really have a way to do that, nor does it want to, most probably. But Dajufi says what EU leaders might be hoping for is that freezing EU cash to Hungary could lose Orban fans at home.
For a long time, when the European funds still came, people didn't really care about corruption because their living standards was also rising. But now the living standards for the general Hungarians are kind of going down, deteriorating. And in that situation, the luxurious lifestyle of the Orban elite and the family is more irritating than before.
In the meantime, organisers of Budapest Pride say the parade will go ahead as planned in June. And writer Christian Martin says he's going to be there.
This is the 30th Gay Pride, and we wanted to celebrate it. And now it's really not about celebration anymore. It's about fighting.
We have to keep protesting, he says, because if we don't fight back now, who knows what Orban's government will do next. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
The Boston Marathon is one of the most prestigious on earth and a big draw for the world's top distance runners, including Kenyan runner Mary Ngugi. She's been training for the race, which happens a week from today, but she's also got another big project on her hands back home. The World's Bianca Hillier has our story.
The Boston Marathon is always held on the third Monday in April, except in 2021. That year, the pandemic forced organizers to move the race to October. The fall date worked out for Mary Ngugi.
And there is Ngugi coming into third.
The Kenyan pro crossed the finish line in third and was later promoted to second after that year's winner was banned for doping. It's her best Boston finish to date. A couple of days after the race, while flying home to Kenya, Ngugi touched down for a layover and connected to Wi-Fi. That's when she saw the tragic news about her fellow Kenyan, Agnes Tirop.
Kenyan runner Agnes Tirop, a two-time world champion's bronze medalist, has died.
A 25-year-old world record holder had been stabbed to death. Police are treating her husband as the main suspect.
Tirop's husband was soon arrested and charged with her murder. He pled not guilty, but has yet to stand trial. Ngugi says the news shocked her.
I just could not believe it. And the way back home, it was just thoughts going in your head, thinking like, geez, how promising her life was.
Tirop had just represented Kenya at the Tokyo Olympics and was at the top of her game. Her murder brought attention to the country's longstanding problem with gender-based violence.
There's been history and there's been cases of where girls have been abused. Even if they're not abused, they're intimidated. They feel like they don't have a voice, like they're minor.
For Ngugi, Tirop's murder was the final straw.
And it dawned on me like, seriously, something needs to be done to try and protect and help girls in Kenya.
Ngugi got to work. And in 2022, she launched Nala Track Club in central Kenya. A video on Ngugi's YouTube shows a group of young girls doing drills before a workout on the track. There's more than a dozen of them, aged 15 to 20, and they all live together in the camp house just a few minutes down the road from Ngugi's home.
They live there, and then in the morning, they go out for training, come back to camp, shower, have breakfast, go to school, and then from school, come back to camp. So camp is like home.
All of the girls have left their real homes and their families to pursue running. They run around 50 miles per week, and some of the girls even travel internationally to compete. Nike pays for all of it. Getting stronger and faster is a focus at Nala Track Club, but it's not everything. Nala is a Swahili word meaning queen and lioness, and Ngugi wants the girls to feel that way.
These girls, when they join us, some of them are like really quiet. They don't want to speak. They're shy. They're not confident. And then in camp, we are like, you can be who you want to be. You can be confident. You can dance. They're happy. They're smiling. They're not afraid to say what they think or what they want.
Ngugi also makes sure the young athletes know they have options. If running doesn't work out, they can be a coach or a physical therapist or a photographer. Historically, Ngugi says, in Kenya, those have been men's jobs, not at Nala Track Club.
When I grew up, I didn't know a female coach. I was never coached by a female coach. And I think it's good for the girls to see women in power.
It's easy to imagine how the young athletes view Ngugi as a role model. She's one of their coaches, a mentor, and a mother figure. A recent Instagram post even shows Ngugi doing one girl's hair. But Ngugi says the admiration goes both ways, and she'll need their support to make it to the finish line of the Boston Marathon.
They'll be watching. They'll be watching, yeah. They're always watching me. I'm not just racing for myself. I'm racing for them as well.
Ngugi will toe the line in Boston next Monday, April 21st. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. A giant in the world of Latin American literature and politics has died, Peruvian author Mario Vargas Llosa. He was the last living member of the so-called Latin American boom of the 1960s and 70s. That was a new crop of Latin American writers who rose to prominence and captured the international literary imagination. Vargas Llosa died yesterday in Lima at the age of 89.
Ignacio Lopez Calvo is a professor of Latin American literature and culture at University of California, Merced. He described Vargas Llosa's literature as fiction rooted in realism.
So his literature was mostly an investigation of the search for personal freedom, protest against oppression and dictatorship of any color. And that's pretty much what he's known for. And it's sometimes shocking the difference between the writer and the public figure, because in real life, he supported Milei in Argentina, Bolsonaro in Brazil, which are all far-right politicians. Mm. But if you read his novels, he seems like a very liberal thinker in terms of ethics and moral issues.
Well, Ignacio, let's talk about his politics, because Vargas Llosa was a political writer, but his opinions were by no means stuck in permafrost. Talk about his evolution in politics and how that emerged in his writing.
Yeah, so if you read his first three or four masterpieces, they're mostly a diatribe against authoritarianism. And this was influenced because at age three, he met his father. His family had told him that he was dead, and his father suddenly reunited with his mother and put him in a military school. He ruined his childhood pretty much. So he became obsessed against this figure of the authoritarian, which translated into a criticism of the dictator of his country, Peru, Odría. He belonged to a communist group in the University of San Marcos in Lima. But later on, he progressively adopted neoliberal policies. He admired Margaret Thatcher, Karl Popper, all these thinkers from the right. And I think the older he got, the more far right he became, with shocking declarations, things that were very shocking to his readers and to Latin American intellectuals in general, which tend to be to the left.
Yeah, and Vargas Llosa's involvement in politics then culminated in this failed presidential run in 1990. He was critiqued in part for his supportive views of privatization and free trade. How does that episode affect his legacy as a writer?
So the most iconic work, which in my opinion represents how he felt about the presidential elections, was the Feast of the Goat, which actually takes place in the Dominican Republic, not Peru. But it's about Trujillo, the Dominican dictator, Rafael Leónidas Trujillo. And in my opinion, it's a smokescreen to talk about Peru and its politics. And what happened in 1990, you know, at one point he said in an interview that, you know, countries get the presidents they deserve. And of course, he was referring to Alberto Fujimori, who beat them in the elections in Peru, and then became a corrupt politician, you know, with a paramilitary murdering students and professors and stealing tons of money. He ended up in prison. Fujimori was a Nikkei, a Peruvian of Japanese descent, and he wrote this novel, The Bad Girl, in which the evil character was a Japanese character. So it definitely affected his writing.
As to that book, The Feast of the Goat, I mean, given what you were just explaining about the metaphor with Peru and the Dominican Republic, I mean, what insight does that novel provide into what was driving Vargas Llosa's opinions, political opinions?
So at the middle of the novel, Trujillo is killed, and the rest of the novel is the consequences of all these 40 years of dictatorship, where there's no political education and there's no way to replace this guy. So the country becomes chaotic. And it's sort of saying, you know, don't be blinded by dictators. This is what happened in Peru with Fujimori, and I warned you, is pretty much what he's saying.
Given that Vargas Llosa swung from left to right, I mean, it's kind of a mirror of the national swings of many Latin American countries. What is his reputation across Latin America?
Well, he was actually a big part of this turn of Latin America to the right. He was extremely, extremely influential. He, you know, opined on every conceivable political issue in Latin America. In Spain, for example, he was very much against peripheral nationalisms. He was very vocal against Catalonian independence, Basque independence. He supported right and far right parties openly. And yeah, he actually, I believe that he was influential in the imposition of neoliberal policies in Latin America with his public discourse.
The recent election results in Ecuador with Noboa and the visit of President Bukele of El Salvador to the White House today, I mean, how do you see those fitting this trend?
It's unfortunate, you know. I think that this turn to the far right with Milei and Bukele and other politicians is a turn towards authoritarian. The very authoritarianism that Vargas Llosa talked against, whether it is from the left or from the right, is happening from the right in several countries. Yeah. You know, and he was very open when, you know, when Augusto Pinochet was almost detained in arrested in London.
Of Chile.
Of Chile. Vargas Llosa said, why are you guys only arresting far-right dictators? Why not far-right, far-left dictators, right? He was talking about Fidel Castro, Daniel Ortega, and other leftist authoritarian figures in Latin America. So he was very open against authoritarianism in general of any color.
Ignacio, how will you remember Mario Vargas Llosa? I mean, precursor to the current right-wing trend or just a simply great writer?
Oh, to me, he was an impressive, innovative, incredible writer, and I don't share his political opinions at all, but that does not. I separate personal life as much as I can from their writings, and Mario Vargas Llosa is a towering figure in international letters, without any question.
Ignacio Lopez Calvo is a professor of Latin American literature and culture at UC Merced. He joined us to recall the legacy of Peruvian author Mario Vargas Llosa.
Join us tomorrow when our reporter takes us to Tijuana, Mexico, where the atmosphere around migration and asylum has changed dramatically in the past 3 months. It's part of our regional coverage this week of issues at the Tijuana-San Diego border.
The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting today from the Catherine and James Whistler Studio at KPBS in San Diego. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people. From the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. MacFound.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include the Kelsen Foundation, Roman Mars, Gavin Selmanese LLC, the Schmidt Family Foundation, Ed and Lillian Schneider, and Marianne Tagney. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.
From PRX.